You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a health reporter who's been looking at the difference between what makes people feel safe versus what may actually be safe for them. Now, President Trump's campaign says it will seek a recount here in Wisconsin. Unofficially, Joe Biden got about 1,630,000 votes. Trump finished with 1,610,000, a difference of 0.3%. The winner gets the state's 10 electoral votes. In a statement, Trump's campaign manager said, quote, there have been reports of irregularities in several Wisconsin counties, which raised serious doubts about the validity of the results, end quote. He didn't elaborate on what those alleged irregularities were. In the state legislature, Republicans were hoping to pick up a few seats in the Assembly and Senate to secure veto-proof majorities, but came up short, so the next 2 years in state government may look a lot like the last two. And there are some big issues to tackle coming up, including redistricting, the state budget, and the pandemic. You can join in with your thoughts on the elections here in Wisconsin at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Trump campaign should, in fact, pursue a recount? What's your hope for state government with the continued divide, a Democratic governor, a Republican legislature? How do you want to see them work together, if at all? What other issues are you concerned about at the state level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonah Ralston is Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. His research interests include state politics and voting behavior. Jonah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob, and I'm glad to be here on November 5th rather than 4th. I'm actually a little more rested today.
We're more rested, and we know a little more at this point than I think we would have at this time yesterday. Hey, what... Big picture, wherever you want to go with it, what struck you about how things came out here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think what we really need to think about going forward as political scientists, I'm thinking of my own discipline here, is we once again have egg in our faces with the polling results. There was at one time in October a poll that came out from ABC News, a reputable pollster organization, that showed Biden up by 17 points. Okay, so that was clearly wrong in an outlier.
Nobody really thought that was going to be right, I think.
No, but many of the polls were wrong. And it looks like maybe what's going on here is we have to think about polling going forward. Maybe it's not accurate the way we're doing it now. And this is the second time that the polls have been pretty wrong. And so kind of what's going on here, if you look at back with the Pew Research Center, just a couple decades ago, they were getting 36% response rates when they would call people for surveys. That's down to 6%. And if you look at pollsters, they won't release this information, but it's generally assumed their response rates are down to probably about 3%. It's really hard to extrapolate for the general population out of just 3% when you're getting a response rate that low.
Looking at this 20,000 vote deficit, of course, unofficial tally, canvasses still come where they double check the math, maybe a recount. But at this point, a 20,000 vote difference, given possible changes in the canvas, a possible recount, is it likely for the Trump campaign to make up that much ground?
Well, what's kind of interesting about this is that Governor Walker has even said, former Governor Walker has even said that it's very unlikely to change. Clearly he's a Trump supporter. But the reason he's saying that, there's a lot of factual evidence to support it's unlikely to change, is that in 2016, there was a recount and the margin only changed by 130-ish votes, right? I think it was 131 in favor of Trump. And that was a $3.5 million recount, in a very small change in votes. And the really, I think during the canvassing is when we're likely to see the most change. That's of course what happened in 2011 with the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election, where that clerk in Waukesha County hadn't reported 14,000 votes. I believe it was from Brookfield. And so once those votes got reported, it actually changed the outcome. But that's rare. That's uncommon. And that's during the canvassing, that auditing period when they're looking and checking all the results, all the tallies, all the reporting. The recount itself, if that happens, that's unlikely to change it, right? It would be during this canvassing period when they get trying to get to that official result.
Let's talk a bit about the legitimacy of the vote. There are conspiracies and misinformation flying around online. There was some grumbling after that Brookfield correction, but it was a correction. Those were actual votes actually cast, votes that came in late in cities around Wisconsin this time around. They were absentee votes that were counted all at, and then released all at once. People saw a big change and wondered about that. Anything worry you about the legitimacy of the count we have in Wisconsin?
No, definitely not, Rob. In fact, it looks like the clerks have done a great job, as they typically do. And you're right. In that case, in the 2011, there was concern. So they had a recount. And the recount, if I recall correctly, only changed the margin by about 300 votes. So once those 14,000 votes were accurately reported, then the whole election was, made official. Once the recount took place, again, there was very little change. So during this canvassing period, the clerks will be double-checking everything. They will be, making sure that all the vote totals are accurately recorded and reported. And we can rest assured that, voter fraud is very rare. It's highly uncommon. There's just not much incentive for an individual voter to cast a fraudulent vote, right? The penalties are severe, and it's unlikely to make much of a difference. And so sometimes errors happen on the part of poll workers or on the part of clerks. That's just human fallibility, but it's certainly not intentional. And it's very unlikely we're to experience any major cases of electoral fraud.
Talking to Jonah Ralston from UW-Whitewater, political scientist, talking about election results in Wisconsin and what the future holds now for state government. Let's bring on a caller. David is with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment about the state of gerrymandering in Wisconsin. I'm just hoping that in the next 2 years, Tony Evers is able to work with the legislature to make more fair maps. Like right now, we just have maps that don't really give Democrats a fair shake, and I think it leads to a lot of the divisiveness that we have in the state and just parties not working together across the aisle. So I'd just like to see a government that actually represents the will of the people.
David, thanks a lot for the call. And Jonah, that's on the to-do list for 2021, new legislative maps for Wisconsin. What are you looking for there?
Certainly the Republicans were hoping for a better result in the state legislature. They were hoping to get a supermajority so that they could have the ability to override any vetoes from Governor Evers, because they will draw those legislative maps. But as we know, they fell short. They fell short both in the Senate and in the Assembly. And so what that means is that the legislature will draw maps. Undoubtedly, Governor Evers will veto those maps, and then it'll end up in the courts. The Republicans are already maneuvering right now to try to get this in the state courts, so that way it ends up with the a more favorable environment for them in the state court system. The Democrats will be countering that by trying to maneuver this to get it into federal courts, which they think they will have a better, more favorable environment there. So it'll be interesting to see how that ends up. But, I have no doubt that judges will end up deciding these maps.
I mean, or they could work together like grownups. I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, Rob, that's a funny thought.
We're analyzing the results of the fall election, specifically for the state legislature and what two more years of divided government could look like. Jonah Ralston is our guest, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about how Wisconsin's elections shook out? What do you think Republicans and Democrats should work together on? How do you want to see redistricting get worked out? Thoughts on the state budget? That's coming up too. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the fall elections here in Wisconsin, the outcome, what it all means for the next couple of years for state government. Jonah Ralston is our guest, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. He specializes in state politics and voting behavior. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, your hopes and fears for what could come out of state government over the next couple of years. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to another caller now. Sharon is with us in Ashland. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what'd you want to bring up, Sharon?
This is kind of an ongoing sore spot for me that involves a lot of different areas, not just politics in the area, but there still is a terrible lack of broadband access in northwestern Wisconsin. It impacts people in all sorts of ways, and this was yet another way that I realized it's creating negative impact because there's so many people here who don't have any way to just get online and, like, say, check where their ballot is at. There are so many features now where supposedly it makes voting easier. But if you don't have the ability to access it, if you don't have broadband access so that you can go in and look these things up online, it's pointless.
Sharon, thank you so much for calling in. Jonah, this is an issue that politicians from both parties have talked about. Sharon brought up something I hadn't really thought of, how important getting online can be for politics and voting. It gets talked about a lot. Do you think it's been a big issue for candidates in the state?
You know, what's interesting about an issue like that, Rob, is it may actually be one of those areas where we could see some bipartisan work done. What's encouraging in this regard, this is the good news story, which you don't hear too many of these days, right, is that, the legislators did work together on water quality. There was that water quality task force, a series of bills came out, multi-million dollar bills. It was passed with bipartisan overwhelming support in the legislature. It still needs to be taken up by the state Senate, but that's, it's likely to pass there when it is taken up. And, there has been some coalescing around criminal justice reform. Some of the things that Democrats wanted, Evers and Mandela Barnes wanted have been actually in some of those Republican proposals that are being put together. So there are some issues where I actually see the legislators being able to work together with Governor Evers and getting something passed. You would think broadband access for rural areas would be one of those. It's kind of like infrastructure and transportation. There's really no Republican or Democratic way to build a road, right? This is kind of the same idea here with broadband access. So, there is hope, that they can work together on this.
Sharon, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go to Bill with us now in Eau Claire County. Bill, hello.
Hello. I guess my question would be with, like, the Electoral College and everybody wanting free and fair elections and whatnot. The electoral, we're worth, what, 10 electoral votes?
Yep.
And we've got 72 counties. Well, if you look at the state, how it's broke up, basically the major cities are the ones that are electing our governor and president. Would it be possible to break up each county so that they're worth an equal account of the Electoral College and even when we elect governor?
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. So a couple of things there. Some states, Jonah, I know, I think Maine and Nebraska split up their electoral votes by district. Some people like that because it's not all or nothing. Some people don't like it because if you don't like gerrymandering, that's another thing that can be gerrymandered.
Right. Yeah, it can go either way. And what's interesting in this election is it looks like one of Maine's electoral votes will go for Trump, even though the state was won by Biden. And it looks like one of Nebraska's electoral votes will go to Trump, even though the state, to Biden, even though the state was won by Trump. Yes, thank you. And so there, that is an interesting way to do things. We could consider that here. But as you mentioned, the risk is that right now the districts are fairly gerrymandered. And, and there's a lot of evidence to support that Democrats are not getting the number of seats that their vote totals would suggest in many of the recent elections. So, there would be some concerns about that, I think, that you raised that are, quite viable. Some states are actually signed on to the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And so that compact between states, if enough states join, what they would do is they would just award all of their electoral votes based on who won the election in their state. But again, that's not enough states have signed on to that yet for the compact to take effect. And so there is a movement to rethinking how this electoral college system works. It has been in place for a couple hundred years, and people are wondering if it's outlived its usefulness.
Thanks a lot for that call. Hey, in our last minute or two, Jonah, something that's on my mind, again in Wisconsin, we have a presidential vote that comes within 1%, right? This time, last time, you go back 2000, 2004, then to Barack Obama was the exception running away with it. I think a lot of people studied Donald Trump as the outlier in Wisconsin because he was a Republican who won, but maybe Barack Obama was the outlier in Wisconsin. What do you think?
Yeah, it's quite interesting that you say that, because even if you look at some of the recent elections, like Walker and Evers, for example, they've been hotly contested. And so you do wonder if Wisconsin is, you know, becoming quite polarized between, you know, the different parties, and if the competitiveness of Wisconsin will continue going forward. It seems very likely. I would wager.
Well, Jonah, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Jonah Ralston is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. We talked to them about what's ahead for Wisconsin after the fall elections. Republicans will retain their large majorities in the Assembly and Senate, but didn't pick up enough seats for veto-proof majorities. Now, news about where we stand with the presidential race is still a work in progress. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of more than 35 books on American politics, media, campaigns, elections, and election law. He joins us now with the latest. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been in a holding pattern through, I think, this whole day. Anything changed so far?
Well, nothing really by, let's say, since yesterday and really today. We know that, just to update everybody, that we have Wisconsin and both Michigan that have been called, again, all this is unofficial, put into Joe Biden's camp. Right now, we also know that we have some new services that have called Nevada, some that have, not Nevada, have called Arizona. And if that were to be the case, then he's very close. That is, Joe Biden is close, within 6 electoral votes of clinching. But no one's called this officially yet. We've got counts going on in Pennsylvania, where Trump's lead is narrowing, and also Trump's lead in Georgia is narrowing. And today, I think the other big news was that judges in Georgia and in Michigan rejected efforts by the president's campaign team to stop counting ballots.
Now, David, in some ways, it feels like, you know, this is a late determination, this election. It's just a couple days. We kind of, in a lot of ways, expected to be here, right? If it was a close election, we knew there were going to be states that had a lot of absentee ballots, early voting, that by law they couldn't start counting until Election Day, including Wisconsin, including Pennsylvania. This isn't really a surprise, is it?
None of this is a surprise at all. Everybody always thought it was going to be very close in the Electoral College. Even months ago, before we had the pandemic, clearly the pandemic, and add to it nationwide, nearly 100 million absentee ballots coming in, of which, again, critical swing states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, the same states that were decisive 3 years ago. We've got an incredible number of absentees. As you pointed out, they can't be counted till after Election Day. And this is what we're really seeing at this point, the slow, deliberative process. And it's not because of election fraud. It's because of what? Just the opposite, ensuring that there is no fraud in the elections by taking this very slow, deliberate process to count ballots.
Now, what are you seeing when it comes to legal challenges from the Trump campaign? You mentioned a couple of key ones rejected by judges so far. Those probably won't be the last ones we see, though, right?
They won't be the last ones, but they're an indication that it's going to be very difficult for the president to be able to halt the counting of the ballots. I think they've tried so far to make allegations that there's been widespread voter fraud. Those complaints have been largely rejected. They've tried to argue that ballots that came in before or that were cast absentee and that are being counted after Election Day violate federal law. Judges are largely dismissing that. So it's going to be difficult. So I think the next stage is going to be, at this point, the ballots are going to get counted. And then if there's any other legal challenges to be mounted, it's probably not going to be until perhaps when the state canvassing boards meet, try to certify the elections. And at that point, depending on the margins of victory, I think you could see possibly some challenges and you might see some recounts go on. So it may very well drag on, as we expected it might, for a few weeks.
Now, I want to ask a question about your state, Minnesota. Biden had wanted to add states to the Democratic fold, mostly fell short in those, except maybe Arizona and Georgia. The Trump campaign had hopes, I think, for Minnesota. It didn't pan out, and it wasn't that close there, was it?
It was not that close, but he was hoping that is. Trump was hoping he could flip Minnesota. He got very close, 1.5 percentage points 4 years ago. And the reason why he put a lot of focus on it this year is that of all the states that Hillary Clinton won 4 years ago, this is the one that was the closest. And he thought perhaps he could flip Minnesota and then put Joe Biden on defensive. If he loses Minnesota, he's got to make up another 10 electoral votes somewhere else. And it just turned out that Biden did something important. He showed up and campaigned here, unlike Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, who after losing in our caucus, we still had a caucus then, after she lost in the caucus, didn't come back to campaign. Trump did, and he almost sealed the deal.
David, briefly as a wrap up, I think a lot of people will be refreshing various screens throughout the night. What are you watching for? What bit of information are you really focused on seeing next?
What I'm looking at this point is both focuses on Arizona and on Nevada. We're going to see press conferences, I think, in the next couple of hours from those two states. And if those numbers continue to hold in both of those states with Biden leads, it could very well be as early as tonight that we could see some of the other major news services declare those states and declare that what? Joe Biden has gotten to 270 electoral votes, which is the magic number he needs to win the presidency. So we are either, much to your hopes or much to your fears, we are close to that 270 for Biden.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's political scientist David Schultz from Hamline University in Minnesota. Coming up, how safe do you feel about the coronavirus pandemic? How safe do you think your family, friends, or neighbors feel? We look at our perception of risk and why a lot of us have come up with different and often mutually contradictory answers. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, the country is on course for its highest voter turnout in more than a century as the final counts continue in key states. Jen White has more from you and a reaction to the latest. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the coronavirus pandemic has changed how we feel about a lot of things, being inside, being outside, being around people, around friends and family. And that's related to how the coronavirus has changed what we think of as safe. But our next guest says our perceptions of safety and risk don't always match up with reality, and they may be shaped in part by who we listen to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has what you think about as being safe or not safe changed since March? And have you found your version of a risk? What you're willing to do? What kind of gatherings you're willing to have be different than your friends, family, neighbors, coworkers, bosses? Is it a point of conflict with people who view things differently than you two when it comes to risk and COVID-19? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers health. In a recent piece, she looked into the differences between how people perceive what's safe and what's actually safe and how the coronavirus pandemic has changed things. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda, you've written a really interesting piece. What sets you down this path of these subtle questions about how we think about risk?
Well, really, I got interested in this sort of slowly over time as I began to watch how people reacted to the news that masks were helpful for containing the risk of coronavirus, as we got more specific recommendations on what kind of gatherings we could or could not have. when we learned about ventilation, and all of this information started coming through in a way that was like with a fairly good amount of certainty behind it. And then I watched people either try to adapt to those things or reject them entirely without really sound reasoning or evidence behind it. So I got interested in why people reject new safety measures and why people resist evidence. And then I sort of started to notice another layer of this story where it's people who agree with you on most things, people whose decision-making often lines up with yours in everyday life, your friends, your family. Most of those groups are sort of politically homogenous for most people to a certain extent. And I saw people with similar values and similar beliefs about the pandemic just choosing entirely different ways to behave during it, and all, you know, acting in good faith, thinking that they were doing the right things. So I felt like those two reactions were probably tied in some way psychologically. So I started calling around to ask experts what they thought was going on.
And one interesting thing here, before we dig into what you talk about, sort of a tribal response, this is a weird kind of thing to fear, right? There are some visceral things like, oh, there's a wild animal about to attack me, or thinking about the risk of a violent crime, or even a really visibly effective disease like Ebola, something that we can picture and feel that sense of visceral horror. This is more conceptual in a lot of ways. Does that complicate our ability to assess it and to assess the risk?
Absolutely. This particular type of threat provides like a couple of complications when it comes to evaluating the risk correctly and responding accordingly. The ways that people learn what they should be afraid of come through personal experience. So your own interactions with, say you're hiking and you come upon a bear and the bear chases you. You know, you should be afraid of bears. Or a friend goes hiking and they take a video while they're hiking of a bear chasing them and show it to you when they get home. You understand, although you did not encounter the bear yourself, you understand from your friend who you trust in the video, which you can see with your own eyes, that bears aren't to be messed with. And then there's this third category of learning from authority figures who you trust and who you expect will tell you about things and give you information that you can't have yourself because of the different levels of authority you have in the society you live in. So that would be a leader in your community telling you that we've seen some bears around recently. We've heard some reports. Everybody keep your pets inside. There's a threat around, even though we don't have any proof. And so those are the three ways that we learn about everything, really. From bears to diseases. And like you said, because this is a disease where people, when they die from it, they die at home alone or in hospitals alone. It's a threat that came from far away at first. So the distance between your community and in your social circle and your in-group and the source of that threat or the perceived source of that threat, the further it is, the harder it is to get people to conceptualize their threat level accurately. So because of the type of disease this is, and because it came from literally the other side of the world, we are already on sort of our back foot when it comes to responding accurately and responding quickly.
Talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic, she wrote a piece about our perception of risk, the COVID-19 pandemic, how it's affected our response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Particularly curious if you've had experiences where in your workplace, with your family, your friends, you and the other people had different perceptions about risk. Is it okay to do this? Is it okay to have this gathering? Do we need the masks? Do we need to be outside? How have you resolved that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Amanda, let's get into the sort of the tribalized response you point to. Ideally, I hear from a lot of public health people, you get one consistent message repeated over and over again by leaders, authority figures, experts, and that sort of thing. That's not what's happened here. What have you seen happening instead?
The reaction to the pandemic has been scattered and confused and disorienting and misinformed in a way that makes it a lot harder, even for well-informed, vigilant, caring people to make good decisions. The consistency over time of messaging from authority figures is really, really important when you have a situation in which the threat is coming from far away and it's not affecting people in front of your face. And so we have had, at various levels of government, we have had people spreading misinformation, people likening the effects of the virus and its danger to the flu. We have had people telling you not to wear masks, not to avoid eating inside of restaurants, when, on the other hand, public health officials, the people who study these things and who spend their, you know, it's their life's work to respond to these threats, are telling you masks work, don't eat indoors at restaurants, don't go to parties, you know. They're telling you the exact opposite of the known authority figures that you listen to in everyday life. And that creates this sort of miasma of information where people are trying to parse all of these new facts. And the average person just doesn't have the ability to do it. They don't have the scientific background. They don't have the time. People, you know, everybody is so stressed out. Everybody is attending to kids and people are keeping their kids home from school and trying to keep their jobs or trying to find new jobs. There's just not a lot of extra energy and extra mental space to figure out who's lying to you and who's not.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ben joins us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. You know, over the last couple of days during the election, pundits have been talking about the voter response, and they talked about a division between people who were more concerned about the economy tending to vote Republican, and people who are concerned about the coronavirus were voting for Democrats. And it occurs to me that it's possible, because, like your guest, I couldn't figure out why people were ignoring these clear danger signs. But it occurs to me that there may have been a cynical disinformation campaign from the very beginning on the part of the president to try to get people to support him in the election by ignoring the dangers of the virus. Thank you.
Ben, thanks for the call. Amanda, I mean, people have been weighing the, you know, how much do you let the economy keep going versus trying to stop the flow of the coronavirus. What are your thoughts on what Ben had to say?
I think that he's onto something on two different levels. I think that there was like a purposeful effort on the part of the federal government, on the part of Trump and his officials, to decouple the control of the virus from the progress of the economy. In reality, you can't decouple those things. The way that people go back to shopping, go back to dining, go back to spending the money that they would normally spend is you get the virus under control. You save people's jobs. You save people's lives. You make them feel confident in going in their safety and going back out into relatively normal life again. But what the federal government did was separate those two things instead of making the more nuanced argument about controlling the virus. And when you separate those two things, you have a lot of people who are very much bought into the group identity of being a Trump supporter. You know, you see the crowds at rallies, you see all the merch sales. People have really committed themselves and parts of their identities to this. So if the people whose authority they've committed themselves to says the economy has nothing to do with the virus, we need to focus on the economy, I'm focusing on the economy, this is the only way we're going to save it, even if people given better information might be inclined to make the connection between controlling the virus and saving the economy, they've already built a lot of their self-perception on believing this person who is telling them that he knows the way out. And group identity provides safety too. It provides community, it provides support, it provides a sense of self. So a lot of times people, especially in stressful situations, fall back on that. So you get this ultimately, I think, successful effort to decouple the control of the pandemic from the progress of the economy.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to health writer Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about what the coronavirus has done to how people think about what's safe and what's not in this country and how to weigh risks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your life much, a lot, not at all, as you look at the risk of coronavirus? Why do you think we've divided into two political camps on the issue of a disease? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Amanda Mull from The Atlantic talking about COVID-19 and our perceptions of what's safe and what's not. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Let's bring on another caller now. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
Hi, I just had two quick points. I myself have zero fear of it. I'm trying to live normally, but I'm a stagehand, so I've been totally out of work since March. Now, these are the two very important facts that I've come to this conclusion. March 8th, Dr. Fauci, who is the superior person on this, March 8th, he said, the masks do nothing. Now, is he lying on March 8th? Is he lying now? And number two.
Yes. Okay, I think we lost Ray there. Ray, thanks for calling in. The mask thing, the thought early on was masks didn't work. The science came in, Amanda, and said, oh, wait, yes, they do actually work. That's the progression of events, right?
Yeah, I think that when you look at failures of the pandemic response. There was a lot of confusion early and not a lot of facts early. March 8th was extremely early in studying the virus. And I think that we didn't know the extent to which the virus was spreading through the air versus spreading through droplets that had settled on surfaces and then were picked up by people's hands and touching the face. We over time after that, it became clear that the vast majority of the spread was happening through the air. So once that became clear, they started changing their recommendations on masks. And I think that there was also a admittedly bungled messaging on their hand at first that masks were only useful for people who might be infected themselves. And I think that they overestimated that point because they were afraid that there was going to be a run on masks and then they wouldn't be able to get any for healthcare workers. And I think it is still true that masks are primarily most helpful for ensuring that people who are infected and don't realize it don't spread the virus to other people. But I think that more science has come in now, and we know that there is also a protective element to wearing them if you're not infected, and how much that will help prevent you from breathing in droplets that are emitted by other people. So I think that it is a combination of how much we've learned over such a short period of time, and admittedly just bad messaging from some public health officials at the beginning, when they should have been more transparent on what they were thinking about and why they were making that recommendation.
Ray, thanks for calling in. Sorry if the drop there was from our end. But I want to talk about Ray's other point. He is one of many people in one of those lines of work that has been hit really hard. Bartenders, restaurant workers, people who work at events like he does. They are personally affected economically. There is harm to them. We had some help for them with the CARES Act. Have we done enough for those people who are really taking the brunt of shutdowns, Amanda?
Absolutely not. We have failed them at every level of government, starting from the federal government. The best way to help people in this situation, and there's a lot of them where I live too. I have a lot of friends who are out of work with little prospect of returning soon. But the best way to do this is to do a coordinated federal effort. The federal government has access to resources that state governments and local governments just don't. They can print money. So if we had had a concerted federal effort to make sure that people got the money that they need in order to pay their rent, pay their bills, feed their kids, feed themselves, keep the heat on early and consistently, I think that so many people would be in such a better situation now. But we're we're in a widespread enough crisis that nobody can personal responsibility their way out of this. Nobody can choose their way out of this. You have to work together as a community, as a country. And that is that's the way that other countries have had success with this, with keeping people in their homes, with keeping people fed, while we try to keep everybody physically healthy too.
Thanks for that call, Ray. We're talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about a piece she wrote on our divided views on COVID-19, our perception of risk on a kind of a hard to grasp a spreading illness where our response has gone wrong. Amanda, given that this divide on COVID-19 has fallen along either side of this deep political divide, when you talk to experts, as you look at things yourself, do you see ways to bridge that and get consistent messaging to people as this thing, numbers-wise, keeps getting worse?
Yes, and there's a couple things that are going to influence this, I think. I think that as the virus spreads further, more and more people are going to know someone who has been personally affected by this, and that tends to change personal behavior. It's not going to change everybody's behavior. It's not going to move the needle for all of us, but being the closer in proximity you are to something that threatens your safety, the more likely you are to take it seriously. So as the pandemic spreads, I think you will see shifting behaviors that are likely to keep everybody safer. And then I also think that that we are, what I keep hearing experts say is that if we can get through this winter, things are going to improve, gradually throughout next year. We're going to get better, better medicines, the vaccines are coming. So if we can just be empathetic with each other and not dismiss each other, not assume the worst of each other, and just work with each other on a human level, the people in our families, the people in our social circles, in our communities, and just have like a little bit more empathy for each other, I think that that goes a long way. When you're trying to message behavior change to people, the best thing you can do is just communicate open and honestly and non-judgmentally. And you can disarm a lot of angry people that way. You can't do it to everybody, but people in proximity to you, people who are known to you, I think that just hearing them out and trying to be empathetic has its uses in that.
Time for one more caller. Harlow is with us, calling from near Duluth. Harlow, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up? Yep, you're on the air. What do you want to bring up, Harlow?
Well, recently I had a termite inspection at my house in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and the person doing the work, a young, intelligent, college-educated person, just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, oh, this coronavirus business is just so confusing. And to me, I don't think it's confusing at all. And so I was wondering why he felt confused. And I decided that it was two things, which your guests have touched upon and your Atlantic author has touched upon. I think one is that we don't understand science. The man on the street doesn't understand science. The answers change as we get more information. And in the case of the coronavirus, we knew nothing back last February, really nothing at all. And we know a lot more now. And so obviously, that we apply this greater knowledge.
And Harlow, I'm going to have to cut you off after one point. I'm sorry, we just have a minute or so left. Amanda, the importance, this is a good place to end it, I think, the importance of communicating changes in our scientific understanding as this thing goes on.
Right, absolutely. This is one of the most crucial points, because I think that Americans, especially over the past 4 years, have gotten used to deciding that everything is politics, that everything, you pick a decision, you pick a point, you pick something to believe, and you defend it till the death. And if you change your opinion, you have lost. That is just the absolute opposite of what science is. In science, we evolve our understanding of things over time as more information is known. Changing your position on something is positive, because it means we know more. It means we've added to the knowledge base. It means we're doing a better job than we were weeks or months ago. So I think that people should try to open themselves to that change, because it's going to make your life easier. It's going to make your life safer. And it's going to be what gets us through this.
Thanks for that call, Harlow. And Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Amanda Mull at The Atlantic. She covers health there, and we talked to her today about some of her work covering what makes people fearful for their safety, how that's changed with the pandemic, and why we have radically different perceptions of the risk of the disease and what we need to do about it. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, a lot of people in Wisconsin provide care to a family member or other loved one. Kate's guest is part of a task force that's looking for ways to support caregivers around the state. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at some of how the major ballot initiatives around the nation fared in this week's elections. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.